when you run a private practice, you're not just a therapist, you're a business owner, a compliance officer, a marketing team, and most of all, a human being. The team at Alma gets that at a very real level. They make it easy to take insurance with support and with tools that keep your private practice running smoothly so that you can practice and focus on what matters the most, which is serving our clients well. They have an all-in-one EHR, a peer community, as well as free CEUs, meaning that you're not navigating the private practice journey on your own. You can learn more about Alma and the awesome services that they provide over at sellingthecouch.com/Alma. Alma is spelled A-L-M-A, and if you go through that link, you get 2 months absolutely free. sellingthecouch.com/Alma. Hello, hello. Welcome to today's session of Selling the Couch. I hope you're doing well, having an incredible day. So today's session is all about leaving psychology for coaching. Now, you might be wondering, Mel, I thought this was a private practice related podcast, but the reality is I know that a lot of us are thinking about what we want our businesses to look like. And the reality also is that a lot of colleagues are shifting out of therapy into coaching. And today we're joined by Dr. Corey Wilkes. Corey is a dear friend. He's a licensed psychologist. His website is over at coreywilkesid.com. And we're having an open and honest conversation about this transition. Corey, much like me, went through a doctoral program, internship, training, and became licensed as a psychologist. And just a number of circumstances led him to realize that he couldn't sustain his job as a psychologist, and he decided to shift into coaching. So we're going to cover a number of different topics. One is we just really start with Corey's career goals and what that looked like in grad school and how that kind of evolved and morphed as he went into private practice. And then we really explore what does autonomy mean for Corey and how he's really tried to design his coaching business around this ability to create autonomy. And we wrap up with a couple of different questions. So the first one is, what are the top three mistakes that therapists make when they become coaches? This is based on Corey's own personal experience. Corey also has a coaching course and how to become a coach that he's developed. He went through pretty extensive training to become a coach as well. And so just some of the mistakes. And then, you know, I feel like sometimes with episodes like this, it can be about like very like a, let do this, go in and go and forth and do this. And we actually spend a good amount of time looking at like, what are the cons of actually leaving the traditional mental health and pursuing coaching? Because again, a big part of my responsibility and role with this episode is to give like holistic perspectives on certain things so that you can make an informed decision versus like making a decision. So I'll jump right into my conversation with Dr. Corey Wilkes from coreywilkesid.com. Hey, Corey, welcome to Selling the Couch.
Thanks for having me, man.
So if you don't know, like Corey and I have gotten to be friends over the past couple of years. And if you're watching on YouTube, he's got like contrast him and me, like complete opposite sort of appearance. Yes, all of that, right? But we really just hit it off. And underneath the MMA and all of that stuff, really like big teddy bear and just a incredibly kind and thoughtful person. Just to even share a little bit, like anytime we go to Texas, Corey just goes out of his way to be like, hey, can we hang out? Can we come visit? And just like, thank you for just being you. And I'm just so grateful for your friendship, brother. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation today.
Likewise, man.
That's all you got, man, after I like pour my shit.
Hey, you know I love you. Like that's like, and everybody who listens to this knows you're lovable and worthy of love. So I don't know what else you want me to say other than you're awesome.
Thank you.
There's your validation.
We're talking about a topic that I know a lot of folks are thinking through and navigating, leaving psychology for coaching and sort of navigating that. Like me, you spent many years getting your doctoral degree and you became a licensed clinical psychologist. What was the career goal in grad school?
So actually, early on, I was a business management major in undergrad, and I took a couple of business classes and quickly realized that at least the way business was framed with the classes that I took, I was like, this is not for me. Like there's no people, right? Like all these classes are about numbers, not about people. I care about people. And so then I went through multiple other majors. I kind of was just adrift for a minute, and then I had this like required like adult or child development course. And it was like, Professor Hinton. I was like, okay. So I was expecting some like old white dude who's just like so ancient, and he has like the elbow patches and things. Like when he talks, chalk dust just poofs out of his armpits or something. Like that was my expectation, right? And in walked this young, like 30s, like early 30s, black dude from Memphis. And he walked in. His tattoos, he had like sleeves. He had, very visible tattoos. He talked like he was from Memphis. And he was like, I'm Dr. Hinton. I'm your professor. And I was like, dude, you have my attention because you are in no way what I was expecting. And what I was expecting was super boring. And the way Keelan, because his name's Keelan Hinton, the way Keelan described psychology and how, basically people are like puzzles and psychology is about helping people put those pieces in the right place so people can understand themselves better, we can understand them better, and we can kind of help people heal and grow. And that really, really stuck with me. So like literally that day, I went to what like the bursar's office or registrar's office, whichever, and changed my major to psychology because of Keelan. And we've maintained a friendship at, for, years after that. So, and I got like an undergrad, master's, and then a doctorate. And that all started with Keelan's class. So I originally wanted to go into business, then start, I was like, oh, I'm going to do therapy. And I think a lot of us, a lot of psychologists especially, we go into the therapy world because we were like, oh, if I get a doctorate, I'm at the top of my discipline. I will have autonomy and freedom. And for a lot of us, we have a degree of freedom within our sessions, but there's still a lot of bureaucracy that we have to operate within, especially if you work for a company, especially if you take insurance. And I think that, especially me, but I think a lot of us in the field kind of grew disillusioned because it was like, oh, I thought I would have a lot more autonomy than I actually will have if I continue down this path. And there are ways like private practice, you can get more autonomy. There are some other things, but I was working in rural Appalachia in integrated primary care. So I was working within like a much larger institution with a lot of regulations, a lot of bureaucracy. And I didn't have the autonomy that I need as a person to really show up. So then, and we'll get into this, but then I later kind of full circle back into entrepreneurship just without the business background.
What does autonomy mean for you?
So I talk a lot about like core value work, which I know you know. And my core value is freedom. And freedom is synonymous with autonomy for me. And it really comes down to the freedom to do more of what I love and the freedom from doing things that burn me out. So I love being able to express myself, to speak my truth, and to help others sort of clarify and speak their own. That can be very difficult to do in bureaucratic structures because there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of don't rock the boat, there's a lot of you are required to do this thing in this way in this time frame. I like being able to use my perspective to help guide somebody else. I like being able to use different modalities to, whatever the person in front of me needs to understand or needs to hear, I want to be able to do that. Right? I don't like having to check off very specific boxes or phrase something a very specific way, or all, like when I would do therapy, like, oh, I have to give you a diagnosis in order for you to keep coming back. Because if you are subclinical, then insurance won't cover it. You have to have insurance pay for it, otherwise you can't come in. So now it's like, then you get into like upcoding and downcoding and like all those ethical issues. And it's just like that was really burning me out, in addition to like, you are a member of this program. These are the requirements for that program. And it just, it it didn't feel aligned in how I wanted to show up and how I deeply believed that I would be most effective. So a lot of it now is autonomy of what is most fulfilling for me, what is most intrinsically rewarding for me, both as my day-to-day life, but then also the type of work, the type of people I want to work with, what does that look like? And then now, how can I build my life and my business aligned with those things that truly matter so that I can keep freedom and autonomy, both for myself, my personal freedom and autonomy, but also facilitating the freedom and autonomy of others? What is the best path forward to do both of those?
That's a great way of putting it. You talked about bureaucratic structures and the struggles and the tensions that you had, right, on many levels, insurance, all of that. Was there one central event that made you realize, like, hey, I don't know if this is the career path that I want to keep going down?
A specific thing, not necessarily so much as like, we all have our own opinions about the DSM, especially in the US, how insurance works and things. One thing I realized, so two things. The first was this whole idea of this is a legacy institution. We don't change things. Like I remember one of the places I worked at, we had, an EHR, right? Because I worked in integrated primary care. So we had this electronic health record. And this is, where we put all of our notes in. At the end of this, and it was like a workflow of like step one, you do this, step two, you do, whatever. At the very end, it defaulted to it would send out a copy of your notes to the patient, which it was like, no, you can't do that. And like part of our training was you have to go in and manually click all these boxes to make sure that doesn't go out. And it had been done like this for years. And I was like, can't we just like change the default to like not do that? And they're like, no, we can't. Like all of my bosses were like, no, we can't. I was like, I'm just going to email tech support and just ask him. Like not like separately from all of you. I'm just going to ask him. They're like, oh, sure, that's super easy. And then they did it. It like same day. And I was like, this is the kind of stuff that this it just burns me up of just like, you never even thought to question it because you're like, this is how we do it. And I'm like, this one change saved all of us easily 15 to 20% of the time we were doing on notes, just from something that was easily fixable, but nobody thought to question. It was things like that, like those highly just those legacy bureaucratic structures. And then the other thing was that it didn't fully sink in until after I had switched into coaching, which we can talk about too. But a lot of the therapy world defines wellness as the absence of illness. But just because you're not sick doesn't mean you're healthy, right? So like fundamentally, my role as a therapist working in the therapy world, especially with insurance, isn't to get you to human flourishing or self-actualization or, these other terms you want to put to it. It is my actual role is to get you to be subclinical, right? My actual role is to help you no longer warrant a diagnosis of major depressive disorder, single episode mild. That is the actual role of a therapist. In you accept insurance, all those caveats, right? Like private practice in an affluent area, you have more leeway. But fundamentally, people go to therapy for psychopathology. That is one of the core pieces with most therapy with most of the country. It is for psychopathology. So then my role is to make you no longer psychopathological, which means being subclinical. But it's like there are plenty of people who are like, okay, you no longer warrant a diagnosis necessarily, but you still are in no way really thriving or flourishing. But because this is the model, and unless I take private pay or you can afford private pay, we have to end therapy, this therapeutic relationship, once insurance will no longer cover you coming because you no longer have a good enough diagnosis for them to cover. That was the thing that really, really just burned me out because like there were people like I would work, I'm like, you are awesome. And now we've worked through all these things and now you find like your head is above water and we can really help you like thrive and flourish. And it was like, sorry, my insurance won't cover that. Insurance doesn't cover self-actualization. And I'm just like, so that was a big thing for me.
Yeah, I mean, I've run into that too, right? And then you feel like, I mean, it's a formula for burnout because it's like, then what do? You just move to the next client, same process kind of happens. And yeah, I mean, I think I followed a very similar path, right? Of what, questioning like my role in all of it, like what it, like all of that, right? And then this larger sort of maze that we often have to navigate, whether whatever the bureaucracy is, right? Insert whatever. Was it an overnight thing for you to like decide to leave like traditional clinical work and enter coaching, or was it more like a these things keep happening, I'm teetering on burnout, I gotta make a leap, or I gotta do something else?
Was certainly multifactorial, right? So one, I had really good experiences with my practicums and with later jobs. But my internship, one, that inter my internship year was the closest I've come to like clinical depression in my adult life. It was absolutely horrific. And that's just a whole story. But basically, no, everybody hated their job largely. And it really showed. And the place actually, after I graduated, because it was APA accredited, after they're like, we're not doing this internship anymore. And everybody left, like all the supervisors left for different jobs. Like it was hellacious. But that gave me a really good glimpse into like, okay, cool. I don't want my life to look like this. This specific thing, I will avoid it at all costs. And that year was when I kind of started, I think, dabbling in, let me read some books on entrepreneurship. Let me read some books on like the craft of writing, because it's like I have all this knowledge and all this training. Because like I think a lot of therapists and psychologists, like we get really disgruntled with like the self-help industry, right? And when you go to a bookstore, psychology and self-help are in the same section, right? So a lot of us with like true expertise, we look at these books and like there's just so much like snake oil here, or so much just like the most generic things that aren't actually helping people. The issue is a lot of those fake gurus are really good at talking to a lay population. A lot of experts suck at talking to lay people, or a lot of the knowledge we have is locked behind paywalls and academic journals that are super jargony that even most of us don't enjoy reading, or access to us is gated behind like private practice paywalls and things. So it's like, well, where do lay people turn when they want to learn actual psychology? And it's like, and personal development, like true, like, self-help kind of stuff. Where do they turn? Well, they can't really turn to us unless they find us, your local provider, right? Because again, state lines and jurisdictions and geography, like that's a whole separate, even with SciPac, that's a whole separate conversation, right? Or they go to the gurus. I wanted to bridge that gap of I have the true expertise, but also I can speak to a lay population. So I started learning because it's like, okay, now people can get re access to real information, right? So I started that process during, early on, like internship kind of thing. Because it's like, I have to have a backup plan. I have to have a way out of this, in the next 5 or 10 years, because this, I cannot do this. So that was part of it.
Can I pause you there? Because you said, I knew that I couldn't do this for 5 to 10 years, right? I think if I'm being honest with myself, like when I was on internship and postdoc, I think I was so fearful of like getting a stable job, right? That thought of like entrepreneurship like didn't even exist for me. So what made you even think that?
Yeah. So like I kind of referenced before, like I went into this because I really wanted to help people and I value my freedom and autonomy.
So it was a values kind of thing.
Correct. And then I quickly realized, oh, what success in this job, what success as a psychologist actually looks like, right? When we talk about like, the highest tiers, that ultimately means becoming the director of a program, behavioral health director, maybe the president of your state psychological association. And I'm like, I don't want to be the president of a state psychological association because all of these conventions are people preaching to the choir. Everybody in the room knows largely everything the person up top is talking about. Most of us largely are there for CEs.
Before we continue with today's podcast session, over these past several years, I've had the incredible opportunity to speak with hundreds of therapists in private practice, learning what's working for them and all of the things that they're navigating. And one of the real things that we often don't talk about with private practice is all of the different skill sets that you have to gather and accumulate, especially because most of us don't come from a background in business or marketing, and many of us come from things like community mental health or working for a group practice. And for many of us, there's a real potential that in the process of building private practice that you can run yourself into the ground. Before I started STC and when I was doing clinical work, I was part of a group practice And one of the real things I remember just navigating is it wasn't just about the clients. We had to do a fair amount of admin work. And just all of that admin work really took a toll. And I remember I would spend nights and sometimes parts of weekends trying to do that. And I could tell I was just always on this edge of teetering on burnout. Alma, our podcast sponsor for today, aims to solve that issue. So what they do is it's kind of an all-in-one, especially if you're a solo practitioner that wants to take part or all insurance. So they handle everything on their end, from billing to continuing education to support that makes the real difference, so that you're actually getting reimbursed every 2 weeks while they even wait for insurance, which was a real challenge when I was in the group practice, because the group practice would often have to wait for the insurance to get reimbursed before I could be paid. Alma has a cool, unique discount for Selling the Couch listeners. That's over at sellingthecouch.com/Alma. Alma is spelled A-L-M-A, and that includes 2 months absolutely free for you just to check it out. That's over at sellingthecouch.com/Alma.
Because we have to renew our license. And yes, this is a very cynical, pessimistic view of it. That has just been my historical experience with all these things. Occasionally you'll get something, somebody, a new presenter, but a lot of times it's just like, these are the same things we, especially at the doctoral level, we all already know, right? And then like, as like a BHP director, it's like, now you have a clinical caseload and an administrative, you know, schedule as well. And it's just like, you're expected to see, especially in the medical model, you're expected to see anywhere from 10 to 16 plus patients a day. And I'm just like, so I just got to go from one to the next to the next. I'm like, I feel like a cog in a machine. I don't feel like I am a doctoral, a doctorate holder at the top of my expertise, you know, in my discipline, where I should have, one, be making a lot of money, and two, have a lot of freedom. I'm making good money relative to my profession, but I'm not making good money relative to many other professions, right? And that just, it really disillusioned me, because I'm like, oh, you know, in grad school, I'm like, oh, I'm going to get a doctorate. I'm going to have all this freedom and flexibility. I'm going to be making, you know, six figures within the first couple of years. And then, you know, all this stuff. And then it's like, you get into it and it's like, no, like, you can make six figures if you do a lot of assessments, if you see an insane caseload, but largely, I mean, maybe if you become director of a good place, but I knew directors who made like 70K. And it's just like, you have a full caseload and a full admin load, like, and you're making this, right? Because you don't know the worth, the value you bring to the table. And this place isn't going to tell you how much it is, but your physician colleague is making 4 to 5 or 6 times as much as you. And it's just like, but then we talk about parity. It was a whole thing, man. Like, it's just, it, so those were a lot of the things that were really like adding to my own disillusionment and burnout. But the thing that really kicked it off was, during COVID, I had negotiated a remote position. So I was working, you know, physically at a company. And then we were moving across state lines. And I was like, hey, I'm going to quit because I know I can't, you know, keep working here and live somewhere else. And they're like, well, actually, why don't you just do a remote position? Everything's the same. We'll renegotiate your contract, but then you can keep working here. I was like, oh, that's awesome. 2 months into that new contract, they sent me an email, the COO. And she was like, hey, in 30 days, you're fired. And like, no explanation. And talked to my boss. They're like, oh, your paperwork's great. Everything's on time. You're seeing plenty of people. Patients love you. Coworkers love you. You're a model employee. But because you are exclusively remote and we are now pulling everybody back into the clinic during COVID, just a reminder, during COVID, they were like, you're fired. So I had 30 days and 3 paychecks worth of runway. And I couldn't get another job out of the state I'm licensed in. I wasn't willing to move back. And in order to get licensed in the new state would have taken 4 to 6 months, because the board only meets every other month and they only see like 3 people at a time. And they were already booked up for the next 2 meetings, right? More bureaucracy. And I was like, I've spent 12 plus years of my life to get a doctorate, to practice therapy. And I literally can't practice therapy anymore because I don't have 4 to 6 months to wait to get my license, to then wait another handful of months to get on all the boards and stuff of the licensure stuff. Like, I can't wait 6 to 8 months to be making money, right? And again, and this was early CyPack, so that wasn't really an option. And even now, CyPack doesn't have the level of flexibility that hopefully it does in the future. So I was like, I literally cannot practice therapy right now or slash anymore. So it was like I was burnt out, but then this was like, the kick out of the nest that I retrospectively needed, because it's like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to be an entrepreneur now. So I guess I'm going to figure it out. I didn't have business training. I didn't have a business degree. So I actually read about coaching. The APA had an article about how coaching was a wild west. But because, like, 14-year-old with a TikTok can call themselves a life coach. Like there's in no way regulated. But one of the things this article was saying was, because it is unregulated, people with real mental health training, if we join the discipline of coaching, we can collectively elevate the quality bar for the discipline of coaching. And we really stand out because we have such deep expertise, and largely everything we do in therapy, all those skill sets translate very, very well into coaching. We just have to make a couple modifications. And one of the guys quoted in it was Dr. Jeffrey Auerbach, who runs the College of Executive Coaching. And it's sort of like a for psychologists by psychologists sort of executive coaching training program. Other people with like advanced degrees also go through it, but largely it is run by a lot of like doctoral level psychologists and things. And that really gave me a lot of comfort, because I'm like, a lot of coaching programs I looked at were super generic and like for very like just basic stuff. I'm like, I know all of those things. And honestly, I knew a lot of what we went through in the College of Executive Coaching. It just helped me shift my lens from a pathology model to a wellness model. That was a huge thing it really helped me with. So it was great. But for a lot of us in the therapy world, coaching is a four-letter word, right? Like I remember being in grad classes and we would like actively talk trash about coaching and life coaching and all these other things. And it's just like all of that internalized stigma held me back, because there was so much elitism in the program, in the discipline itself of psychology and therapy. Some earned, some very much not, because I honestly think, man, this is a very like spiky point of view. I honestly think that therapists would be, any kind of therapist would be better served to function, to try to emulate life coaches more than medical providers. We are taught, especially nowadays, we are taught we need to be mini medical providers. We need to work alongside physicians, and an integrated model is phenomenal for patients and barriers to treatment and things. The issue is that's what psychiatrists did. And psychiatrists, like, and I could be making up some of this, who knows? But so take it all with a grain of salt, look it up. But psychiatrists, from my understanding, historically functioned more like therapists back in the day. But over time, so they would do more therapy and prescribe, right? Because like now a lot of psychologists are wanting to get prescription privileges. They would do therapy and prescribe, but then over time it's like, well, I can do a 5 to 10 minute med check and do a refill and make way more money, because I can see 5 to 6 people an hour and just make way more. Let me just do that, and then I can just offload the therapy bit to a counselor, a psychologist, a social worker, or whatever, right? Well, now psychologists more and more are trying to be like, oh, we should get prescription privileges so we can help with this. And it's like, that's the early phase of what psychiatrists went through. And a lot of people have stigma around talking about therapy or talking about some of these other things. And it's like, nobody has stigma about having a coach, right? And I'm not saying you should just instantly call yourself a coach, but functionally, like, oh, what are coaches doing differently than medical providers or psychiatrists, or how we are taught in psychology, that is making them feel, the perception of them, making them feel so much more approachable. And there's more excitement around these, working with these types of people. That I think is what a lot of us in the therapy world miss out on, is the excitement people have to work with us. And I think that is a key piece of like, we're too busy, especially like modern programs, we're too busy trying to play catch up with physicians to think about, well, where are we truly most valuable, and what are other disciplines that, though they may not have the same level of expertise, they have a higher level of success and resonance with people. How can we learn from what is working for them and modify it to our own needs?
That's such a great way of approaching it. I have a couple of questions for you before we wrap up. So one is, what do you think are like the top mistake? Let's even just say one, the top mistake that a therapist makes when they become coaches.
The top mistake. So the biggest one I see is expecting clients to find you. In the therapy world, especially if you work for any sort of like company, they just send you referrals, right? If like, you know, when I worked for medical clinic, I never had to worry about that. Like they filled my schedule. There was a team of people whose responsibility it was advertise to get people or you know, patients were seeing their physician. They were like, "Hey doc, I'm depressed." And the physician's like, "Oh, cool, go see Corey." Right? Like I never had to ever worry about that. And also I was salaried. So I didn't care if I had 10 people or one person show up because my paycheck was the same. When I worked at a private practice, I remember specifically, they bought ad placement at the local grocery store. The issue was, so they spent their marketing budget on these ads. The issue was, if you we call it a buggy, like a cart, like a shopping cart. I'm Appalachian, we call it a buggy. The, you know, like where like the kid sits and like the front of it, not the thing where, you know, there's like the little child safety flap that goes back and forth. Not where that was, where like the shopper is, you know, where you would be looking. It wasn't that. It was if I'm walking towards you, it was this side of where the kid sits. So you could see the ad from 30 feet away, but me, the shopper who is primarily looking here, I couldn't see it. So I'm like, no one can read this ad. No one is looking for this ad. Also, this ad is pointless. Like nobody's ever going to see it. But you just spent your marketing budget because you don't understand advertising and marketing and outreach. But they're like, "Oh, well, we paid for ads." It's like you threw money out the window. You'd have been better off to legitimately just throw it out the window because and then write your number on a dollar bill. So like because a lot of therapists are not trained as entrepreneurs and do not think entrepreneurially, that can be a real big issue moving into coaching because like you're not just a coach. You are an entrepreneur at that point and you have to learn customer acquisition. You have to learn marketing, copywriting, advertising, like and creating, you know, content and which is, you know, content marketing. Like you have to learn these things largely because without that, you are purely reliant on word of mouth, which is really hard to create that momentum early on.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think, especially, I think when you come from exactly what you said, either salary positions or where there's already some sort of infrastructure or system, I definitely think that's like the biggest one. What would you say is the biggest con of leaving mental health for coaching in your experience?
For me personally, like I said, I worked in integrated primary care. So I was part of an interdisciplinary team. And I really enjoyed being on a team and having like, you know, shared records and just like this interdisciplinary like team approach to care. That was really, really fun. Coaching largely is much more solo. However, I will say what I have done to kind of get some of those like needs met, even though I work largely solo. Is collaborating with people, you know, on a regular basis and doing like short-term projects with people. That has been really helpful. But it can potentially be lonely if you come from an interdisciplinary model.
I'm going to ask a silly question. Is there like a group supervision equivalent in coaching? Is that like a norm or is that?
So specifically when I went through the College of Executive Coaching, which it does give you qualify for like ICF certification if you know what that is or care what that is. It's just an extra credential. Going through their program, it qualifies you to like fill out extra paperwork to get an extra piece of paper. I didn't because I'm like, I have a doctorate, I don't need an extra certification. But during the program, you do get supervision specifically with a lot of less good programs. Probably not. Because I don't think they take it as seriously. Because again, coaching is unregulated. You don't have to have supervision, but they offer it. Yes.
And then is it the norm? Like, and it sounds like the norm is not that the typical coach has like supervisors or they're going into their own group supervision where they're discussing like a coaching client or any of those.
No, like everything you did in like grad school for therapy, coaches don't do. Because again, there's no regulation. So there's no formality to it. Like you could literally read Atomic Habits, and I'm in no way disrespecting James Clear. Like, dude wrote a great book, dude knows his stuff. But I see people, they will literally like, "Oh, I read Atomic Habits. I'm a habits coach now." And it's like, buddy, you ain't. But there's no board saying, like, "Hey, you don't have this credential. Hey, you haven't had X number of hours. You can't call yourself this." It's like a nutritionist versus a dietitian. You can't call yourself a dietitian because that is a regulated term, right? As a protected term. Anybody can call themselves a nutritionist. It is unregulated. Same thing with coach versus therapy.
Yeah. Corey, the last question I have for you is, what advice would you give to a therapist who is considering becoming a coach listening to our session?
One, learn to stop seeing coaching as a four-letter word. Like, so much of your skill set directly translates to coaching. Even like your diagnostic abilities can translate, even though you're not diagnosing, right? Because you're really good at identifying patterns and figuring out, like, oh, this is probably what's going on. Let me test this hypothesis with the right questions, right? Active listening, building rapport, asking questions, like all those directly translate, right? I have a whole course that goes through all this stuff of like, here's how to actually become a coach and like, here are all the skills and everything. Like, I have a course that walks through all that. But that's it, right? Like, if you're a therapist, you have damn near all the skills to already be a coach. The missing pieces are moving, like shifting from a pathology or a disease model to a wellness model. And all that really means is assume the person you're working with is already pretty healthy. And then from that assumption, move forward rather than assuming all this person has clinically significant anxiety, depression, whatever. And that is what the focus is. Like, no. The focus is rarely that, because that would get you into therapy territory. The focus is typically, I want more out of life than what I currently have. I'm getting in my own way. I have become the bottleneck. I have some mindset or some habit issues, and I just want help with that. I want thought partnering to move forward, to flourish. That is what they want. All your stuff directly applies. If what you're passionate about falls under therapy, then do therapy. Like, if you really like helping people, you know, navigate like borderline, you know, traits or suicidality or schizophrenia, or if you really like assessments for like disability evals, totally cool. Keep doing therapy. But if what you're passionate about doesn't directly fall under therapy, you would probably love coaching.
I imagine that was going to be my last question. I had one more question. You said there's this balance. Sometimes you're teetering between coaching versus therapy. When you see somebody and you're like, hey, this is getting into therapy territory, like, what are the internal questions that you ask yourself to be like, to parse out coaching versus therapy?
Great question. And this is another like mini module I have in the course. Like, hey, if you're a therapist, like here's some things to consider. A big thing, I have in my contract that you sign of like, you agree that if I, in my own discretion, believe what you have going on is more related to therapy, you will either pause coaching or get a therapist in tandem. Because though I maintain a license, I am not doing therapy anymore, right? So that is really important. To have that caveat up front. Obviously, when you're doing like a discovery call, like before you actually sign somebody, you kind of suss out some of that of like, you've got some other things going on that I am not trying to go into that quagmire with you right now. So there's like a filtering process. But the other piece too is like, you know, I've had coaching clients before where like we're doing business coaching, but in the midst of that, maybe they're like a loved one dies or they go through a divorce. And it's like, I can't just be like, nah, we're going to talk about revenue over here. It's like, okay, let's touch on this as so far as it directly relates to why you're seeing me. And let's both mutually agree on where this line is between coaching and therapy, so that if we start to come close to this line, we both agree like, okay, yeah, this is something I should just, you know, talk to my therapist about. Great. Awesome. Yes. Moving forward. Right. The one thing very quickly that we learned that I learned in grad school was like the idea of a Yavis client. Like, I think it was like young, attractive, vocal, intelligent, whatever, social or something. And it was like the quote unquote, like perfect client. And I remember being told, you will never get a Yavis client because that just isn't what therapy is about. That's a pipe dream. You may get one or two throughout your career, but most of your clients aren't going to be Yavis clients or Yavis patients. Coaching largely is just all Yavis. I'm not saying like they're attractive or young necessarily, but like they're all vocal, they're all intelligent, they're all very insightful. Okay. That is a huge difference you see too, because coaching is private pay. That naturally skews a lot of the demographics and the people you're going to see, right? Especially if you charge more, that just they're going to be a little more stable in a lot of areas. So it makes those conversations generally a lot easier. Like, hey, remember where we said like this line is? It seems like you're approaching it. Or a lot of times they'll just be like, I feel like we're approaching this line where like I should just switch and just go to a therapist. Let's get back on track and talk about this over here. That is how most of those conversations have always went. Like, we might touch on it a little bit of like, oh, you know, yeah, you say your mood's kind of low right now. Like, that's super understandable. Have you thought about getting a therapist? Oh yeah, actually I already made a call this afternoon. Cool. Then you can talk with that with them. So it hasn't been the issue that when we've had ethics classes in grad school, we're like, oh my God, like, is a banana actually a banana? Or is it like, what if they have an eating disorder? Then like, if I have a banana on my desk, like, am I actually coercing them? Like, what if I had those conversations about like, is a banana really a banana? And I wasn't even like a Freudian, right? It's the whole thing. Those aren't the issues you run into as a coach, largely.
Yeah, it's incredibly like helpful to hear because I think you're right. Like, I think when you don't know, the tendency then is to just kind of turn it black and white, right? And there's definitely more nuances there. Corey, appreciate you. I'm grateful for our friendship. Where can we learn more about you and the work that you're doing in the world?
So I am Corey Wilkes, PsyD everywhere, Twitter, Twitter X, whatever, LinkedIn. My website is CoreyWilkesPsyD.com. If you go to CoreyWilkesPsyD.com, you can find all my stuff, my newsletter, the courses I've created, if you're curious about any of those, everything else I'm up to, CoreyWilkesPsyD.com.
Awesome. And I've gone through, I have not done the coaching course yet, but the values-based course, I recommend this course one because I think just in terms of like really getting clarity on your values, it has been, especially I think the past couple of years, as I've really thought about the direction of STC, that course, just going through it, it's just been incredibly helpful. Corey, appreciate you, man, and have a great rest of your day.
Likewise, man. Take it easy.
Later. Hey there. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Corey, and especially if you are in a season where you are thinking about becoming a coach or adding a coaching component to your business. I hope that today's session has just been really helpful for you. Again, be sure to connect with Corey. Again, his website is over at CoreyWilkesPsyD.com. And, you know, I was just reflecting on this conversation. And I think the one thing that I took away is that decisions like this are never easy. They often have a lot of layers to it. And I think one thing I've just noticed is I think in our field, right? Like there's sort of like those folks who are traditionalists are like, you know, you've got trained as this, and this is the path that you need to go on. And then I think the other side of it, right, which is like kind of, I guess, an extreme version is, you know, okay, you had this training, but now kind of unregulated, like do what you want because anybody can hang up a shingle, become a coach. So I hope more than anything, today's session has just given you a little bit more of a holistic understanding of it and also given you some resources that you may want to look into if you do want to go down the coaching route. I'm in this interesting season, right, of like having gone back into clinical work, but then also having STC and I'm just learning, like, there's just a lot of things to navigate. And maybe my situation's a little unique, but I don't think it is because, you know, I've got this clinical arm and then I've got STC and we do courses and consulting. And I think that's just the one thing that I would just say is like, really be up to the T when it comes to the legal and ethical stuff. So even with STC, you know, and private practice, those were like two different LLCs, two different bank accounts. Like very clear on, you know, who I can work with in each of those domains. Again, be sure to connect with Corey over at CoreyWilkesPsyD.com. And I hope that you enjoy today's session. Have a great rest of your day and I'll see you next time. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Selling the Couch podcast. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit www.sellingthecouch.com.
Hey there, thank you so much for tuning in to today's session. Just wanted to also let you know that we have a free email newsletter that goes out every week. You can download it over at sellingthecouch.com/newsletter. Basically, that newsletter contains some of the stuff that's happening behind the scenes with STC and also with my life and how I'm balancing and trying to balance being both an entrepreneur as well as building a life around my family and my health as well. And it also contains the latest podcast episode and some of the stuff that I'm doing on LinkedIn, some of the strategies and things that are working for me. And then finally, a brand new section called On Mel's Mind, where I take a video or a book or a blog post or something like that that's inspiring me for that week, and I share how I'm implementing it both in my life and in my business. Again, you can download that over at sellingthecouch.com/newsletter. And if you are one of the 3,700 colleagues that have been a part of the email newsletter, I so appreciate you, and I'm grateful for your support. we genuinely try to make these helpful. And just based on the data and based on the feedback we're getting, it seems like we're doing a really good job. So appreciate you, and I hope that you have a great day.